Welcome to Emotional Sobriety.
Luckily, we have Carol Carter back, and we're all here on the pod, Tom, Alan, myself, and we're going to be getting into the next Grapevine article pertaining to emotional sobriety. But first, I'd like to do a little roundtable check-in.
I continue to get more and more energy. You wouldn't believe the crap I'm accomplishing around this house, getting everything cleaned up. And I was even, as I told you guys, I was late for the podcast because I was shopping online for a power washer to do my back deck. So I am the opposite of what I was just a couple of 3 months ago, where I didn't have energy to do anything. Now I've got energy to do lots of things.
You know, Trump's got the art of the deal. And you could probably write a book, Tom, on the art of washing meticulously.
Sure, I'll do. I'll get right on it. I'm going to make some notes during the podcast.
Because I got a vacuum cleaner very recently, and you had a bunch of nuanced perspectives on that. And I get
I just told you what brand to get, and you had already bought it. But
that's more than
I think
I know.
I think you got a good brand. I just don't think you got my favorite brand.
What was that, you guys? Now this is turning into a shopping.
Oh, Dyson vacuum cleaners, man. The cordless Dyson vacuum cleaner, they change your life. They make life good. You know, it may rival emotional sobriety. I'm not sure. I'll come to our Thursday night meeting or buy a Dyson vacuum cleaner. Your choice.
What's it like, Tom, on the other side of this like huge health upset you had over the last 6 months? Like, you're looking great. You're feeling so much better. And like, does it just become kind of like, do you just try not to think about it, or is it pretty impossible to not be in touch?
I think about it. I mean, I'm sure it'll get to the place where, you know, it'll settle back in, and, you know, I'll get back to taking things for granted. You know, trust me, I'm a human being. I'll do that. And you guys feel free to remind me that if you notice I'm doing it every day during the day, I'm aware that I have energy to do things. I still get tired. I mean, in some ways I just call it being an older guy, but it's like, you know, I worked on the back deck for quite a while yesterday, and came in and needed to, just wanted to lie down, take a nap. And I did. And felt better, but I'm very aware that I have energy to do things. I have energy to think about things. I was just limited so much before. It was like, first of all, I didn't want to do anything. The energy was depleted enough to where I just didn't have interest in doing anything. You know, at the hardest part of it, end of last year, it was just, I was like no battery.
It's tough, man. It's like, you're totally, it's like somebody unplugged you. I mean,
exactly, man. It's like, it's not, there's no gray area. It's just like, yeah, I got nothing.
Very true.
So I'm very grateful.
Yeah. You know, I was sharing everybody as we got on, you know, that since I fractured my femur, I met with the doc this last Tuesday. The good news. I appreciate it that he owned that he made a mistake.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
On the prescription that my PT should have restrictions, which one of would have been limited abductor muscle development at this point in time until that bone heals more. So he took responsibility for the fact that I did exercises I shouldn't have been doing, and that I was taken off the walker before I should have been taken off the walker and put on a cane. So I appreciated that. You know, the good news is that the top of the femur, which I think is called the grand thoracanter or something like that, did not break off from the femur.
Good.
Had it broken off from the femur, they would have had to go back in and surge, do more surgery, and found a way to pin the thing to the bone. And it would have been a total mess. And I'd probably be in a lot more pain than I'm in right now. So he says, you know, if you continue to stay with the restrictions and bike duty, you know, laying in bed as much as possible to rest that leg. And he says in 6 months, you know, your recovery should get back on track here. So it's protracted things or delayed things a bit. But the good news is that I've got a doctor that's humble enough to say I screwed up. So I can trust him.
No kidding. No kidding. Well, and when you were talking about it before, you were to your credit, you were willing to take on some of the responsibility yourself. You were saying, I think I maybe push it was pushing myself too hard and that kind of stuff. And I think you said in the conversation with the doctor, he actually made the comment that, that wasn't on you.
That isn't, no, he said, you're doing exactly what you're supposed to be doing in PT. You push yourself in pain. You told the guy that you were in pain and it was his job. He says, if anything, he needed to listen to you a little bit more. But he says, look, it's his job. If you told him you're in pain, then he needs to be checking in and say, how is this for you? Or is this exercise okay? Didn't happen. This time around, I'm learning a lot about what it means to be a patient and to advocate for yourself. Is that instead of just deferring to the authority and letting them take all the responsibility, I got to keep my hand in the mix, man. And so that's a lesson for us, and it's an emotional sobriety lesson, isn't it? As soon as I defer myself to a should or whatever it is, I've now disempowered myself. Not good. And Carol gave me some advice. I've been struggling with some other issues about getting some help around here, and so gentleman's coming by today that somebody's recommended. That's the godfather for this person I trust a lot. And I'm going to hire him for this next week while I'm getting prepared to go to LA. So thank you, Carol. You've been wonderful with me through this whole thing. She
You're
sent me these
welcome.
great loofah stick sponges that I can use to get my bottom leg because the stuff I got from the hip kit was meaningless. I mean, it didn't do anything. It was
Yeah,
worthless.
Carol is not only wonderful and we just love her for her heart, but she's like a catalog of information.
Texas. There's a catalog in Texas. Where are you living in Texas, Carol? Where do you live?
Yeah, I'm just north of Dallas. That comes from studying a lot of different things and being old. I have plenty of experience.
We appreciate your experience and wisdom. See what a value it is to us. How have you been, Carol?
Well, I've been really blessed the last 48 hours. I have had really bad sleep hygiene for years. And it's sometimes it's really problematic to the point where I'm just knuckleheaded. And I've learned that you really can't be very resilient if you don't have some sleep under your belt. It's hard to take things the right way and not take things personally if you're not rested. And two nights ago, I got a full 8 hours of sleep, and I felt like $1 million yesterday. And I did it
Amazing.
again last night. That's two nights in a row. So I'm feeling pretty darn good. I will tell you, I was spontaneous and expressed myself pretty strong way. And I can't discuss the context here, but I did that yesterday with someone. And just kind of blurted out something that was funny and it fit the context, but I got a huge shame attack last night over it. And I got some good feedback from someone who was present that, no, it's not what you're beating yourself up about. It really was appropriate and fit the scene. So I'm feeling better about that. But so I guess two things. One, it's nice to get rest, and I'm going to be working diligently at doing the right things to ensure that I get all the sleep I can, and not too much and not too little. And then the other is, we're really kind of sometimes silly references for ourselves, and we need outside perspective. Because if I leave it to me and I'm not rested, the man, the committee's in, the bully starts talking. It sounds like my voice, and it's not, but it sure sounds like it.
So what was the difference in terms of the sleep? How does your sleep improve?
Someone in a meeting I was in yesterday mentioned about eating disordered people not having a good sense of when they're hungry or not. Well, that is true for me as an eating disordered person. And I think the same is true of sleep. And it's hard for me to tell when I'm sleepy. So I'm not in tune with my body in ways. And two nights ago, I felt sleepy at about 8:30. I shut everything off and laid down.
Yeah, so you listen to yourself.
Yeah, listen to my body.
Wow.
Oh, thank you for that, Alan.
It's so interesting, how desensitized we become to those kinds of things.
Yeah.
remarkable for me that that desensitization sometimes is so, sometimes it's so thorough that we don't, we're not in touch with anything, or what we want, what we like, what we feel. I mean, but it can also be very localized to specific areas, like your hunger, your satiation, your you know, feeling fatigued and tired.
Well, thank you for focusing my attention on that. I appreciate it very much. And one thing I'd like to share about how that's related, those sleep and food, and I had forgotten this, are tied for me is back in the, I guess it was the late 90s, Fen-Phen came out.
Oh, yeah.
And I took Fen-Phen for 45 days. And I nearly lost my marbles because, number one, I had no interest in food at all. And I ate probably under, let me just say, I'm not going to do numbers because that's crazy. That's too triggery for people. But I ate a profoundly insufficient amount of food. But what I observed that was crazy to me is the mechanical part of getting signals. I lost my food pictures that are part of my signal to eat that I never knew I had until they were gone.
Wow. Hmm.
But I also, Alan, lost my sleep pictures, and I did not sleep for 6 weeks. Now, you know, I eventually would collapse and get some sleep, but I could not sense my normal pictures of, oh, it's let's start the bedtime routine. Oh, let's start. I had no clues, no cues at all. For eating or sleeping. And so for me, with my wiring, whatever that is, I don't know how it is for anybody else, they're tied.
Yeah, that's great that you're getting back to touch with it, which is funny. You know, that's what this talk that I gave in the training program yesterday is that.
Yes. That's
look at therapy is this helping people really focus on the important things in their life. And it's really bringing attention and concentration to how somebody is functioning in their here and now. Mm-hmm. And it's such a powerful thing, right? We talked about the three ways that we do that in therapy, looking at the tight therapeutic sequences or looking at the story. This is probably the one I do mostly, is summoning the different self parts into the picture.
Yes.
Right? Yes. Into the picture. And there's those are all three very powerful ways.
Well, that's why I thank you, like I did, for bringing my focus back to that.
I know, that's what it was. And that all of this relates to the survivor. Before we go on with that, Patrick, how's your recovery coming on?
Thanks for asking, Alan. You know, what occurred to me, you were talking a little bit before about you had a death in the family recently, and you're going to be traveling in order to be close to your family that's suffering. And it reminded me of, like, sometimes after my injury recently, when like the thing that I really needed was to be called upon to kind of like step in for other people that were kind of like bruised and battered in different ways. And like, I don't know if there's a lesson in that anywhere, but like, I just feel like, even though like, I'm sure you have no shortage of vectors to help people and, you know, like you can get a lot done from your home office. You don't need to be on the road to kind of like, you know, be out in the world helping people with their recoveries. But I think it's like, I could just sense that this is going to be like a really important week with a lot of like, you know, juicy emotional sobriety things going on for you.
And, I'm praying that today is a harbinger of things to come, that I'm starting to have the fracture starting to heal and there's less pain in that way. The good news is the swelling has come down tremendously in that way. So that's helped a lot. And the fact that it's just localized, he told me that where the bone fractured is where the blood's going to pool right now and all the fluid's going to come. And that's the truth. So if you look at my leg, right where that fracture is, you see this hump of swelling taking place and it's affecting the fracture. Body's pretty remarable, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a doctor helped me with my back pain years ago. He used to say, he said, he you didn't want to mention the fact that the people, so many people said inflammation was the problem to everything, because he would just go into a wonderful lecture about you know, what is inflammation? It's your body responding to right. the need, and it's like, you know, why does all that blood rush there? It's like because it's needed. And by the way, I hate to sound like your mother here, Alan, but you're feeling better. Don't be careful. Don't get ahead of yourself.
Yeah, I'm the person that needs that one, and no question about it.
Well, especially when it's a healing thing. You know, physical therapy ain't gonna fix a bone. It's like, you know, the bone has to heal, and you have to sit still and let that bone heal. And so I'll keep bothering you about that.
Well, listen, we're going to rename this podcast to the Convalescing Four.
Hey, can I ask a quick question, though? So you asked how my recovery was going. What's the best barometer for figuring that out? Because I don't know how well my recovery is going. I couldn't tell you today.
It's acceptance. I mean, if we keep coming back to this term, it's how much I accept where I am at this particular moment and deal with it. And, yeah. You know, sometimes accepting it at this moment means, like yesterday, I had a couple really good cries yesterday. Good. I was so, and I'm telling you, I think that helped me feel better today is yeah. to just myself. You know, it's funny. I was talking to Dr. Margaret Allen. She's a psychotherapist that I work with right now. And I was telling her, you know, I get so conflicted at times about feeling sorry for myself. And she goes, you know, sometimes we feel sorry for ourselves because there's nobody else around to feel sorry for us.
Mm-hmm. Like it.
And that meant so much to me. It took away the shame and about feeling sorry. Because for me, feeling sorry for myself is a bad thing. That means I'm a real loser because I feel sorry for myself. But the way she put it in context was that's your compassion for yourself. Yes. And that's feeling the loss and the pain and the disappointment over what's going on in your life right now.
Wow. Alan, I had a sponsor that used to say self-pity's a good place to visit. You just don't want to live there. I love the idea that there was that permission, because so often in the program, in my experience with the program, is people will go the other opposite way and not give you a little leeway for that, because you know, sometimes we need to whimper and lick
our wounds. I needed that leeway. I just needed that leeway. There's a lot of loss and disappointment in my life, and there's a lot of challenges going on right at this particular point in time in terms of what this new life of being a divorced man with raising at 72, raising a 6-year-old and 11-year-old. My 6-year-old came up with a solution the other day. She said, I know, we'll just have you live with Maddie and I'll go live with Mom for right now. She goes, that way you just have to deal with Maddie and Mom has to deal with me. I mean, it's so cute. I said, no, I've got to see you.
Oh, that's sweet though.
But it's coming out of that spirit of let's try to figure this. And I'll tell you, that's the other thing I've seen with this. You know, there are these opportunities. Now that I'm like this, the girls have helped out more around the house with things than they've ever helped out before. Mm-hmm. And that's a thing that they can feel that they've got a part and they can be of value in a situation, make contributions. So, you know, if I look for it, there are these little nuggets laying around through this whole thing. But Patrick, have you found any nuggets from what you're going through? I mean, anything that you would say you would have missed had you not flown off the side of that wall?
Well, I think I've talked about it a little bit with you guys. Presence, like the essence of that mistake I made that caused me to have that terrible injury was that I was already, I was getting two steps ahead of where I was. I was already thinking about, you know, I don't know what I was thinking about, the sandwich I was going to get when I climbed down from the mountain, rather than where I was on the mountain and where my hands and feet were and how that might lead to calamity. And I think in general, like I've been noticing that a lot on the other side of the accident, is even when I'm in a, you know, in a state of ecstatic joy, I'm already thinking about, I'm having trouble staying in that moment and being present and being fully open to it. And my sponsor finally talked me into doing 30 minutes of uninterrupted meditation, where I just like sat in a room and breathed and tried to kind of get grounded with that. And I don't know what my resistance is to that. I know that it's definitely connected to my addiction problems, because, you know, I always kind of like to have one foot inside my life, one foot out. What comes up for me when I'm in the presence of you guys is, I would like to be less selfish. I feel very kind of in my own. I'm a real basket case, because I struggle with presence, and I'm also totally in my own head most of the time. But I'm not wallowing. I'm not going to wallow in that. Like, you guys are all doing stuff that kind of like puts you in contact with other people, and you're being of service. And, you know, I do things, but I just feel like maybe I could ratchet up the attempt, you know. My sponsee is doing good. I've got one sponsee and he's doing fantastic. He goes to a meeting every day. He calls me every day, does a 10 step every day. He's working, he got a new job and he's working full time. So that's the one. I no matter how selfish I'm being, I guess if I'm doing right by him, if I'm in touch with him, that could be one thing that I'm doing that's, I don't know, putting it closer to.
Look at you, you're talking about not staying focused on the present and getting ahead of ourselves. Look, that's part of emotional sobriety, isn't it? The more I stay grounded in right now, the more the better I can cope with what's going on around me. As soon as I leave right now and get too much in the future, I can miss a step, like, you know, you did. Or can you remember back to what happened? Did your foot slip, or did you not get a handhold? Or
foot slipped. I was climbing down. Two hands were on the rocks. All four limbs were on the rocks, and then kind of inched myself down with both of my hands, and kind of let my toe slip off, and I was kind of trying to reach the lower rung with my foot, and anyway, it just did not connect, and then my weight pulled me down. And, you know, if I had just taken more time, you know, then I think it would have turned out differently. But thank God, no spinal injury, no nothing that can't be mended.
Same thing that I'm saying, you know, thank God it didn't worse, and you too, for all of us that are struggling with these things. It's like, we're here to talk about it.
Right.
We are here to talk
about it.
It's
a technique. It's a technique for gratitude. It's like, you know, it's like we kind of make light of that sometimes, but it's like, you know, go to a parallel universe in which the worst thing happened, and then come back here. Just takes a second, and you're grateful. You know, I just had this car accident in which I broke my leg, baby, like we're talking about. But, you know, I didn't have a car accident in which I was broadsided by a semi and killed. It's like, you know, it seems like, you know, somebody said, well, you're just playing mind games. I go, yeah, but my mind games work. They give me perspective.
Yeah.
I just need to say before we go on to the thing, it really does come down, and I mean this sincerely, it really does come down to what brand of vacuum cleaner you have.
Well, if I have the second best, then it's okay.
Before we go to our reading,
I was just going to say, why don't we jump into this? Can I
say one thing to Patrick before we do, if you don't mind? Something standing out about the way I'm hearing your story about the accident, and is it possible that your foot slipped instead of you let your foot slip?
I heard that too.
Really, I suppose it's possible.
I just wondered, because it really could. Not sure, because I wasn't there, but I mean, it really could have just been an accident and not a knucklehead move. I mean, it really could have just been two surfaces were slippery together.
There's your podcast right there, buddy. That everybody listening. We're gonna do this other thing, but that's enough right there for the day.
I will meditate on that, Carol. That's really interesting. I hadn't thought of that before.
We'll meditate for 30 minutes on it.
Yeah.
And by the way, the more you meditate, the more you keep one foot out, and one foot in. Just saying. Okay, yeah. What's our reading?
What doesn't slip again?
You little.
You guys,
that's pretty funny.
All right, what are we doing? What we're doing is we're going through the grapevine. And we've been reading the stories in the grapevine. The whole month of January's grapevine was devoted to emotional sobriety, our favorite topic. Or Patrick, you kick it off, then me, then Carol, and then Tom.
All right, sounds good. Party Guy by Ed L. from Wrightwood, California. Many nights after the bar had closed, he'd still be downing whiskey shots. Oh yeah, the wife and kids. In the spirit of our ninth step promise, we will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. I'd like to share what has, thus far, been my most memorable and meaningful resentment. Don't get me wrong, it's still a resentment and it caused me considerable turmoil at the time. But in true AA fashion, I've mined the silver lining inside this cloud and discovered rich lessons in the poor behavior exhibited by a fellow AA member. At 2 years sober, I worked the program, dedicated myself to service, and immersed myself in our town's AA fellowship, where there are 4,000 residents, yet only about 40 alcoholics routinely attend 4 meetings a week. With so few members, it's easy for strangers to become friends, who then proceed to pull your covers while simultaneously enriching your life. With such close quarters, members can have profound effects, good and bad, painful and pleasurable, on one another.
As I slowly, never quickly, began to let other people into my life, I started fellowshipping with AA members outside of my meetings. Eventually, there came a day when I hosted my first AA potluck and a dozen familiar strangers came to my house. Near a table loaded with deviled eggs, by the way, I love deviled eggs, loaded with deviled eggs and angel hair pasta, cold cuts and hot wings. Oh, my mouth is starting to water. I'm hungry. Sweet peas and salted pork. A member with 18 years of meeting attendance whispered in my wife's ear that he'd listened to me share for 2 years and, in his not so humble opinion, I was not an alcoholic. Notice that I didn't say 18 years of sobriety, as meeting attendance doesn't necessarily equate to sobriety. Quote, the same guy once told a newly sober former drinking buddy of mine that he hadn't been in AA long enough to work the 11th step.
I love my wife's reaction to this statement. She burst out in laughter. After all, she'd been shackled to me for 18 years, and he'd listened to me for 2 years at 1 hour long meetings in 3 to 5 minute spurts. So in spite of the poor behavior exhibited by my AA acquaintance, I asked myself the question, what is he seeing me that makes him believe I'm not an alcoholic? Here's what I've learned about myself. Whether I went to the bars at 3 o'clock in the afternoon or 9 o'clock at night, I always stayed until closing. Thank God there was a last call for alcohol, otherwise I wouldn't have known when to go home. I exercised this drinking behavior for many years with a wonderful wife and 2 small children at home, whom I abandoned 3 or 4 nights a week. At closing time, the bartender would yell, "You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here." Except that's exactly what I did sometimes after the doors were locked. I partied after hours with willing bartenders in dimly lit saloons and afterward wantonly swerved my way home in the pickup truck.
I was a pattern drinker, preferring the beer and a bump approach to drunkenness. The bump of whiskey got me where I wanted to be, and the beer allowed me to stay in the bar until I was ready for my next bump, which depended on when I finished the beer, which then led to the next bump, which depended on finishing my next beer, which went on until the lights went out, either the bar's or mine. For me, party was both noun and verb. I'm the kind of guy who partied to get ready for the party, who brought people home from the party so we could continue to party after the party. My partying knew neither time constraints nor inappropriate places. Typically, I was the last to leave and on a number of occasions, I was confronted by the anxious turned angry host or hostess who I only met earlier the same evening.
I habitually confused stimulus for happiness, and I assumed it virtuous behavior to party until 4 o'clock in the morning and still go to work 3 hours later. I frequently sought out lower companions, feeling superior by immersing myself in inferior company. In retrospect, we were birds of a feather. I was, as they say, sleeping with dogs, waking up with fleas, and in one case, crabs. My name nickname was Ed the Dead. With 5 churches and 5 saloons in our town, except for one time with my daughter and numerous times in AA, I never darkened the doors of the churches. The darkened bars were more to my liking, spending saturated hours and boku bucks in cavernous smoke-filled dives. In Columbus, Ohio, my home group had been the Bitter Creek Saloon, and in Wrightwood, California, the Raccoon Saloon, and in between, the rank and rowdy haunts inhabited by drunks.
For AA, 95% of the money I spent didn't come with a receipt. Since AA, 95% of the money I spent comes with a receipt. I never expected to spend much in the bar, so I went with $20, staggering over to the ATM at the local bank 3 or 4 times a night for $60 or $80 or more, $20 a time until closing. I didn't have enough money for a pint until I finished a pint. Then I had enough for another fifth. These are some of the insights that hindsight revealed in considering my friend's resentment making a statement. I know now that it's my desire to not drink, not what I did or didn't do or do and don't share in a meeting that makes me a welcome member of AA. And this still has been my most useful resentment to date.
I first heard it said at the Marina Group in Oxnard, California, that AA is the largest club in the world where no one came in wanting to be a member. I'd also wager that nobody in their right mind ever came to AA. Wow.
That guy's very familiar to me. I can't imagine why, but
wow. So much to unpack in this, isn't there? I mean, it's an interesting story. I mean, you know, we can take it from so many different points of view. So I'll kick it off with some of my observations or comments on it. You know, first of all, somebody coming in uninvited without getting consent gives his opinion to the guy's wife about whether he's an alcoholic or not. Well, see, that's one of these issues about boundaries, right? What right do I have to tell somebody else what they are and what they aren't, and especially if it's unsolicited? So you got to just wonder, I mean, there's something off with that person, no question about it. And then, you know, I think it was an emotional sobriety moment for him to say, what did I do that left that impression in the meetings? I mean, see, instead of just being angry at the guy for what the guy did, he wanted to take some responsibility. It's the same thing if somebody lies to me. What am I contributing to making it hard for that person to be honest? No, I'm not taking responsibility for that person's behavior, but I am taking responsibility to that person, right? To the relationship I have with that person. So that stood out to me as an emotional sobriety moment. And then he started to unpack it. Now, it was interesting to me as he unpacked it, he focused on his drinking as whether he was an alcoholic or not. And I think that this is sometimes where our focus is too narrow. He didn't talk about the fact that if he's in a bar that late at night, what's going on at home with his wife and kids? Like, there was no awareness of how his alcoholism was getting him to underfunction in his family, to not show up, to not be present, to not be in relationship to. It was all about what he needed, and there was nobody else in the picture. His wife wasn't in the picture, his kids weren't in the picture, and even as he talked about it, that he wasn't in the picture. And then the interesting thing, he says, nobody comes to AA that's in their right mind. And I would say the opposite. I say we come to AA because we are in our right mind. There's a part of us that does know that we need some help. Now, it may be that we projected it on someone else. Maybe we've made somebody else responsible for our motivation. That's where an intervention comes in, or
right,
comes in, or something like this. But the reason AA works is because there's something in us that knew that something was missing in our life, that something was wrong, that we were off in some way, and that there's a sense of us, or else we wouldn't be able to wake up. And once we start to wake up, we can see that there's a force in us that's pretty darn cool when we start to get in touch with it. And that leads us into the discovery of a new relationship with our higher power, a new relationship with our fellows, a new relationship with our problems. I mean, the transformation here is phenomenal. Just phenomenal.
Well, yeah, I have on my free download thing on my website, I have probably one of the articles that's downloaded more than any other is one called Motivation. And it just has five, you know, because I've never been a believer in, I mean, as a matter of fact, it kind of gets on my last nerve when people will say to people who have our problem or others, you know, well, they're just not motivated. I hate it when therapists say that, because, you know, that's like saying a doctor says, that's like the oncologist saying, well, I can't help this person. They have cancer. You know, it's like, that's what we treat, you know, but motivation to this checklist has the point I want to make about it, just one little piece, which is what you said, Alan. The first ingredient in that recipe, so to speak, for motivation is simply dissatisfaction, you know? Yeah. So a lot of times we're trying to talk ourselves out of dissatisfaction when we need to be listening to it. It's like, no, you need to be, you know, oh, don't be so negative. It's like, no, sometimes I need to pay attention to what's not working. And I need to pay attention to, you know, I need to listen to my own complaints and take responsibility for what to do with it. I kind of identify with the guy who made the judgment. Not an alcoholic. This is my theory on these things. I believe a lot of us, myself certainly, well into recovery, have an alcoholic ego, and I mean, for me, that's a part that takes pride in my alcoholism. It's like when I'm very seldom around anybody who drinks anymore, because it's just who I hang out with. But when I go near Carol over at Dallas way, that's where all my old college friends are. And, you know, I usually end up going out with some college friends, and, you know, a couple of them probably should belong to our club, but most of them are those weird normal drinkers, you know, the ones that'll turn down a drink, you know, or somebody asks you want a drink and they think about it. What? It's what are you thinking about? It's
what's the thing about?
But that's right. But what I've noticed about myself through the years is it, to this day, when I'm with a group like that and they're taking three quarters, I never order an alcoholic drink without pointing out to the waiter or waitress that I'm an alcoholic. It's like there's a part of me I realized not too long ago that still wants everybody to know I could drink you fucking under the table. You know, it's like I'm just not going to do it. You know, and it's like, what a weird thing to have an ego attached to it. But, you know, the whole point is it led me sometimes to judge other people's, you know, alcoholism. Oh, you're not so bad. But I also realized that I judged my own when I was first in the program, because other people who would tell these horrific stories that I had not experienced, they were dangerous for me sometimes. I made them dangerous because I kept thinking, well, maybe if that guy's an alcoholic, then maybe I'm not. I love what he said. He just said the program. He said the reason I'm here in these meetings is because I have a desire not to drink.
I was going
to
say, somebody reminded me the other day that it's not the drinking that makes you an alcoholic. It's the thought that leads to the drink. I met my girlfriend's sister about a week ago, and we had lunch together. And it didn't occur to me until afterwards that unlike my acquaintances with most people, I don't know, in my 5+ years of recovery, I'll let a lot of people know up front that I'm in recovery. Sometimes I'll take a little bit of extra effort to kind of figure out a way to kind of thread it into the conversation, in the least obnoxious way I can find. I'm not really conscious of like what's behind that or like why I felt the need to do that, but it seemed like a little bit of a corner being turned or something that it just didn't come up, and I didn't feel the need to really like discuss it and or to like announce that this is a central part of my identity. But like it is. When I sit in the meetings and I go to meetings every week, the level of obsession that I had for so long and the kind of lengths that I went to in order to get my fix, while I have discontinued that practice, I have to just the writing's on the wall that like, you know, there's just something in my mind that drew me to that behavior. It was a Herculean undertaking to kind of like change course. I do have a condition, you know what I mean? And I've been kind of learning how to medicate that without substances for a long time now. And anyway, that's what came up for me when I read the story.
Tell me if you disagree, but in my example, in your example, we're the same because we're both still ego driven in that. It's like you're protecting your self perception and how you want people to see you by not sharing that piece of information for whatever reason. I think everybody should know about me. It's like, you know, that may just speak to my own selfishness and narcissism, but it's like it's still, you know, and I'm not shaming either one of us. I'm just observing it. Just paying attention to it. It's like, no, it's not say, you know, because if the goal of emotional sobriety is to not be ego driven at all, then I quit because I'm not going to be able to successfully do that. I can get better at all of this stuff. I believe that. But I don't have to stop being human.
Well, boy, you guys are talking to me on this. How many times have I needed to tell my divorce story over 45 years as part of my introduction? I mean, practically, you know, just early in a conversation. So my attachment to my resentments is still very much an ego-driven thing, which is why I'm so enjoying Fred Luskin's book and my awareness of my attachment to my resentments. So I can start letting some of that stuff go because there's a whole lot more to me than just being resentful about some things. Tom, I really related to what you said about your alcoholism because I am so proud of the fact that at 72 and three quarters, I was working 15-hour days, 7 days a week. That is some sick shit right there. We just started off our discussion today with a check-in, and I admitted that I don't listen to clues from my body, cues from my body about when it's time to eat or go to sleep. I had to shut all that down to pull off that level of dysfunction.
Yeah, your version of holding your liquor.
Exactly.
Yeah, you're still standing at the end of the night, you know?
Oh
That's
man, that's some swaggery shit right there. And
it.
you know
Damn
what?
right.
It's sick. So, I'm gonna laugh at me, and then I'm gonna be spending some time paying attention to my body and listening. I will say this, I am improving some in that I cannot tell you how many times I write to people or start to comment on things with friends and back out of the story I was just about to add in about how hard I worked before I retired. I have to erase that before I hit send. So at least I'm becoming aware and I'm trying to shut it down, but it's still very available and handy and ready.
That's helpful to me, Carol, because it's like I'm a person who shares too much. And you probably know that about me because you've been around me a long time. It's like, you know, it's so one of the things I one of the reasons I like I always prefer correspondence, texting or email to phone conversations. It's but one of the advantages of that is it's not unusual for me to write an email and then and I'm not a compulsive person who reviews my emails and edits and all this other stuff, but sometimes I can just look at it and I'll take out two paragraphs Yes. And realized those were unnecessary. I just wanted to write them.
Yeah, I wanted to say that to myself, but I'm not needed saying it to say it,
but I do not need to send it to this person who usually I barely know. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. We are definitely funny critters. And I'm just
You know that, Carol, because I don't think I've ever sent you a brief email in my life. It's like, one thing leads to the next story. And, it's like each paragraph begins, well, that reminds me of another story. Do you remember that time that so-and-so? And, we can do that because we're close. We're friends. But it's like, I don't need to be doing that with everybody.
Right. Right. Another thing that impressed me about today's story reading that reminded me of last week's was, he couldn't go home to his family, but he definitely found his way home. Mm-hmm. In his dysfunction, he could not manage to take himself back to the house, but he definitely, in his journey of recovery, has found his way home again. And that just brings me to tears because our recovery family is home. It's home. And that doesn't mean everybody else in our lives is home too, but I mean, without that, there is no home for people who are wired like me.
That feeling is so strong on the Thursday night community that we put on.
Yes. Yes.
Really, that for so many people.
Yeah. And Tom often says on the first night of one of his retreats in Nashville, we've just come to know each other better in 3 or 4 hours than people who have known us for 25 years will ever know us. And
Friday nights at the retreats. People don't believe it when we do it, but
we fall in love.
3 hours into that, you're absolutely at home, everybody. Yeah.
We fall in love with each other. We care so deeply for each other. We see each other's vulnerability and wounds. And we just love each other back to health. And that, to me, is our Thursday night meeting. To me, it's one of the most functional 12-step groups I've been in. And I've been in a couple that, work so cool. And then if you're in one that doesn't work for you, find another one.
Carol, we need to get those retreats going again.
Tom one day in Dallas at a retreat. Mm-hmm. And just that one day of work had me toss my scale. That I had I used to get on the scale in the morning to decide what kind of day I was going to have. Just one day with Tom, that sucker was out of the house and gone. I'm just so grateful for you, Tom. Thank you.
And I remember that day. I don't remember the details of that day. I'd be lying if I said that, but I do remember meeting you, and I remember that group, and it was a wonderful experience with Susie and Cynthia.
The thing that struck me too is at first I did appreciate what Alan said about he looked at what he might have done for someone to come up with an opinion about him. But I will say that I have had moments in my life, certainly, where I cared a lot about what others thought of me. And as I retired last summer, there was a little bit of buzz about, why is she leaving? Why is she not? People I vaguely knew were calling up to just check and see if I was okay to get the inside story. There was no story. I just decided to retire. And I was very aware at that point of honestly not caring what anybody thought about it, which is rare because I've had moments like even last night of worrying about what someone thought about something I said yesterday. But those pockets of freedom from caring about what anybody else thinks are pretty precious. And I didn't have any of those until our meeting started 4 years ago.
I mean, I appreciate the fact that he stepped back and said, hey, did I contribute to anything about this thing? But at the same time, you're right, Carol, it's that we can't allow ourselves to be defined by other people's limited opinions or ideas of us.
And many of us learned that growing up, to stay safe, always having to know what side of the opinion we were on, that kind of thing, to stay emotionally or physically safe. But for heaven's sake, we're adults today. We really can reclaim that freedom to just be.
Well, that's from the very early on. I had to go home from school and walk in the house and feel the air in the house before I knew how I was doing.
Feel the air in the house. I love that.
Oh, I could do it, man. Yeah. People who don't grow up in dysfunctional families, they're not psychic. It's very funny. If you're feeling horrible and you tell them you're okay, they think you're doing okay.
It's so good to see you guys.
Great love to have you back.
Yep. Thank you. I love this.
Tend your life. Tend your myth. Cultivate your narrative with whomever you are.